All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? This is Mark Maron. This is my pie. I'm Mark Maron. How's that? He is Mark Maron. He is Mark Maron is talking about himself now. This is Mark. I'm Mark. This is WTF. How are you? How's that thing on your head? Were you able to get a haircut? This is no time to buy shoes, is it? I don't know what you're thinking with that. Did your cake come out all right? I know some of you were inspired to outdo me with your cake experiences. Well, I hope your cake made it. I did make some beef stew and cornbread. I'm going to honor the fall of mankind. I'm going to have a fall. This is one of the things that I always miss about living in a place that has well-defined seasons, is that I miss the fall. I miss going outdoors in the fall. I miss that crispness in the air. I miss the heaviness of the sky but the beautiful light of the fall and the colors and just the breathing in that kind of cold air and knowing that you're wearing a couple layers and you got your boots on. I miss it. But as soon as it gets just a little chilly in Los Angeles, as soon as that desert chill starts coming over us here, I put my beanie on. I was wearing my tweed jacket today. I got my White's boots and my Filson pants. I got my flannel shirt on. And I layered up and I sat out on my porch. And it felt kind of fallish. I can't even explain to you. I think some of you know. Fall people know. Maybe it's because I was born in the fall. That's what some people say. Because it really moves me. It changes my whole disposition. I guess there's a nostalgia trigger. I can't really explain the poetry of it. But somebody told me that it's if you have a relationship with the season you're born into. And that seemed to make good sense to me. I'll take it. I'll take it. Today on the show, I talked to Melinda Hill. Melinda Hill is a comedian, and you might know her stand-up. She's also been on a lot of comedy shows like Reno 911 and the Sarah Silverman program, and she founded a show we all used to do around here called What's Up, Tiger Lily. It was at the old UCB with Maria Bamford and Natasha Leggero, and it was actually at a Cuban restaurant, I believe, originally, and then it kind of moved around to places. She's got a new special out called Melinda Hill Inappropriate, and I've known her forever, and she's one of those people where I'm like, what's she up to? Where you been? How you been? And she actually came over here, and we did a partitioned conversation. I put my plexiglass up, and we did the thing, and it was good. It was good. We talked for a long time about deep shit, and I love her. And she did, and I want to set this up at the beginning before you forget. She did want to make sure that you all knew that she gets along with her parents. We have a conversation about parents, and she just wanted to make it clear that she's okay with her folks. Okay? All right? All right. I just want to get that out of the way. I wanted to give you a heads up to a thing here. Someone who's been on this show, a great comedy writer, funny person, Meryl Marco. She's been on The Past. She's one of the original writers for the original David Letterman show. And she's written this book. She's written a lot of stuff. But this is a very unique and personal undertaking she's done here. She's written a graphic novel memoir. It's called We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. And it's hilarious. And it's personal. It's great writing from one of the funniest people out there. And she did her own illustration. So it's got the whole thing is a very personal undertaking, and it's great. Again, it's called The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. We Saw Scenery is the name of the book. So you can check that out wherever you get your books. All right? So nostalgia is what we're talking about. The fall, where does it take you? I've thought about this idea before. You know, it's very hard to look forward with any, you know, reasonable speculation or excitement or hope. No matter what happens, we're heading for difficult times. COVID is out of control. The government's in chaos and malignancy. People are terrified. The economy's buckling. So it's not like you can go like, man, I can't wait till what? You can't wait until what? Till this disease is gone, till this president's gone, till things like start to function again normally. Well, I don't know when that's going to fucking happen. So it's been, I think, a normal thing at this point is, you know, people are just churning through the past, churning through their past in terms of memories, going through stuff, a lot of organizing going on, reflection, and then churning through the past of entertainment because that's what's available to us. But I always start to worry about nostalgia. I worry about hanging on to nostalgia. I like looking back and at least seeing the evolution of different choices I've begun to make in my life to maybe be a different person. I try to have hope, but I used to have this idea, it was a concept that I tried to make a bit, but it just never worked. Because it's based on the idea of your life flashing before your eyes. You know, they say that when you die, right before you die, your life flashes before your eyes. And I always thought, like, well, how long does that take? Does it happen like quickly, or is it like a year? You know, because once you start reflecting or living in the past or being nostalgic about something, you know, or like when old people say it was a different time, they wistfully say, oh, it was a different time. Is that the beginning of your life flashing before your eyes? When does that happen? It's hard to stay engaged because the present is terrifying, but be careful not to get too nostalgic because it may be your life flashing before your eyes. I guess that's the warning. Been doing a lot of cooking. Did I mention that? Made some beef stew. Did I mention that? The beef stew? Don't get too nostalgic. I know for the fall, man, I bought some apples. There's something about it, man. Something about the fall. Eating a crisp apple, looking at a pumpkin, wearing a sweater, breathing in maybe a slight hint of a fireplace in the distance, or if you live out in LA, the entire state on fire. Man, it smells like fall. All of Northern California is smoldering. What the fuck, man? I was going to go on a hike the other day. The air was too shitty again. And where I hike caught fire. I was lucky I didn't go. I always wondered about that. What do? You always got a plan in your head. But usually those plans are about as good as like when you were younger and you thought, hey, if this elevator cable broke, I could just jump up right before it hits and then land safely. Yeah, I got a plan. If I'm on the mountain and it catches fire, I'll just go up to that area where there's no trees and lay down. No good. No bueno. You better run, man. So, yeah, the fall, nostalgia. I had dreams again. I had a Lynn Shelton dream. And it's heavy, man. But it's good. I'm trying to see them as good. I'm trying to see them as visits. My grief has been sort of turned into kind of a baseline sadness. But I had this dream. I've been doing these Instagram lives. I say some shit about some people occasionally. I try to maintain a certain amount of diplomacy. But, you know, sometimes my real feelings come out, tempered but true. But I said something about somebody in a show. But it was just this old sort of weird kind of gnawing resentment that, you know, has been worked over. It's not active, but that guy from Radiolab, Jad, but he once said something to a friend of mine at an event about me, and not knowing it was my friend that got back to me, and it kind of gave me, kind of stuck in my craw forever. So I was just telling the story, but the dream was like, in the dream, I was looking at my phone and there was an incoming call from Radiolab. And I was like, oh no. And Lynn was just there. She was just right in my face. And she was smiling. She's like, what did you do? Why don't you want to answer the phone? What did you do? And she's looking at me smiling, like knowing that I did something wrong. And I'm like, what? And she was just sort of like, what did you do? And her face was right up near my face. And I put my hands and I grabbed her cheeks and I just held her face. And I said, I miss you. I miss you. And she walked a few feet away and she goes, it's real. It's real. Or this is real. I don't know which. And I don't know what she was referring to. Was she referring to the visit or was she referring to her being gone? I don't know. But it did, you know, soften me and it made me realize, you know, it was that energy. Like, what did you do? What, Mark, don't, come on, Mark. Oh, come on. She was such a big-hearted person, big spirit. And I have to be careful not to let mine close up. I have to be careful not to let my heart close up. I have to be careful, you know, not to, you know, to be angry and resentful and mean again. I do miss her. And I do like those visits. And I am really trying to actively make her memory a blessing. So, Melinda Hill is my guest, and her new special, Melinda Hill Inappropriate, is available now on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, YouTube, and most other video on demand platforms. You can also get the audio version on most streaming music platforms. And I've known her for a long time. She's always been on the periphery, if not right in front of me, probably going on 18 years. She's just always been around. I've always been like, you know, what have you been doing? You know, and this is really the first time we talked like this. This is me talking to Melinda Hill.
Look, I wore this in honor of you.
Cat Sabbath, thank you. Cat Sabbath shirt. How many do you have cats? You got one?
Yeah, I have the one.
Just the one?
Yeah.
Did you have more?
I would like to give him a little friend.
How long have you had this one?
This one, Stardust, is about 4 years old.
So, but she's been alone the whole time. Do you find? See, this guy used to have the old ones, so I feel like he's longing.
Oh yeah.
And it makes me sad. Like I'm like, does he need somebody?
That's how I feel. I ask him all the time. I'm like, do you need a little friend? Mm. Should I get you another kitten?
Yeah. And do you feel like you get responses? What are you feeling like she's saying?
Well, it's a he.
Okay. Yeah. Stardust is a he. I'm sorry. I should have asked first. How does he identify? Is it a they?
It's a he, and he believes he's a lion. Mm. So he's not really a cat.
Okay.
But I'm not really sure if he would like another one. Well, that's the risk you take, right? If you get another one,
that
you don't know
like
if they
other?
get along.
Well, I know how he behaves. He's a bully. And he's a fucker. And he used to beat up on the old man.
Okay.
No respect for age, this cat. And it was like, it was a problematic because when Monkey got old and sick, this guy was like jumping on him. I was like, dude. So he was actually, I neglected him.
Hmm.
So this is the first time because ever since I got him, I had the old cats. And he was always sort of the third banana. So now he's got all my attention and he's turning into this other kind of cat. Kind of wild.
Like a happier cat?
He's just becoming more friendly, a little more open, a little more connected. Because when I got one cat, if I'm focused on a cat, I'm checking in all the time. You know, don't you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean...
Right, you walk in, you're like, what's up? Hi.
Yeah, where are you?
Yeah, yeah. But when you have a couple or you're focused on the old guy, my old guy... Yeah, Buster was always like, it was just sort of like, leave him alone. Like, stop it. So that was the relationship. But now it's sort of like, hey, buddy, all the time. And I don't think he knows what to do with it.
Where did you get him?
Showed up. He was eating on the porch of my old house, wild and fucked up and crazy.
Oh, okay.
I don't think he was feral. I think someone had gotten him, had him for a little while, and then he got out. and he was in the wild. But he's only a couple months old, but he was fast and crazy and living in the wild.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like this little fucking, he's a tough little fucker.
Aw, I always tell Stardust, I remind him of the story that, you know. The origin story, exactly. I tell it to him like a bedtime story. I'm like, you were rescued from the Downey shelter. And
Downey, what were you doing there?
Well, several friends knew I wanted a cat. Maria Bamford took me to the Pasadena shelter to get one. And they didn't have any kittens available that day, weirdly. So my other friend Beth took me to the Downey shelter.
Oh.
And that's where I found this little guy. And he was in a cage with a bunch of rapscallions who were like going nuts on the cage. Yeah. And he was the little demure one.
Oh. And you got him.
Yeah.
That's nice. And it worked out?
Yeah. He's part-time rapscallion.
Oh, good.
He concealed it that day.
Yeah.
But generally, he's very demure and sweet.
Putting on a show. Wanting to get out. Yeah. Get me out of here, lady. Yeah. I got your number.
Yeah. Exactly.
We had an old cat back when Mishna and I moved here. We had that Butch cat. And then that died. But we had gotten that cat, another cat, Boomer. And I picked the craziest cat in the place because we went to some shelter. It wasn't like a city shelter, but it was one where it just seemed like most of the cats were cats that people got tired of. Like all the cats looked like they were over 10 and clearly looked like other people's cats. But this one, there was one that was just out of his mind. I'm like, that one. And I didn't realize it until I trapped these other guys that fucking guy was completely feral, completely feral.
Oh, wow. So, like, what was the training process, like, bringing him into...
You can't break him down. These other ones that I had aren't... Maybe in a decade, you can get them to sit on your lap or something. But you can't pick them up. They're tweaked all the time. But, you know, you get used to them. I've had three feral cats, like, real feral cats now in my life. For me, they're good because you got to fight for it. You know, there's a distance there. There's aggressive boundaries, you know?
Yeah.
That's a, and the, like when I get cats that are just sort of like loving fat little cats, I'm like, got a little self-respect. Jesus, look at you. Oh my God. Come pull it together. But like I was thinking about our past, how long I've fucking known you.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
It really is.
Right?
Yeah.
I always want, like whenever I see you, I'm like, what has she been doing? My God, Melinda, what have you been? Where are you? Where have you been? What have you been doing?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's the feeling I get. Now you've got this special coming out.
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Inappropriate.
Where'd you do it?
I did it down the street in Hollywood. Well, down the street from me, not you.
What do you mean? What place?
It's in Theater Row. It's called... Oh My Ribs
on
theater.
Santa Monica?
Yeah.
That weird little Theater Row.
Yeah. Oh,
what is going on down there?
I think there's like a lot of plays happening there, a lot of...
But it's always like, you know, like what is... It's like it's been there forever.
Yeah.
I've done stand-up shows there, you know, at one point or another, but I'm just like, there's not much theater in LA, and I just always wonder how those places work. Do people just rent them out? Did you just rent it out?
Yeah.
Did you do a run there before?
You know, I thought we considered it, but I just did two shows in one night and taped it.
So you shot it?
Yeah.
With two, three cameras?
I think there were three.
You pulled the crew together?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Did you use both shows or just the one?
You know, the second one was pretty unusable, so it's primarily the first one.
Isn't that always what happens?
That
happens. Like you always shoot the two, and rarely, in my experience, I haven't used a lot of the other one.
Yeah, no, we just mostly went with the first one, and Comedy Dynamics is putting it out, and it's coming out October.
So you just did a deal with them after the fact?
Well, I made a list of places that do specials, and I thought I would just go down and call the people on the list, and they were the first name, and they just took it, so I didn't go to any other names.
Good for you. Be a fighter. Really. Go out and get what you want. Don't let anyone walk all over you, Melinda. Wait, the first people want it? Let's take it, right? We take it, right?
Well, Maria, because I'm really good friends with Maria Bamford, yeah. and she had just done her special with them, and she was like, they're amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like a glowing endorsement.
So she was championing you a bit? Did she bring you into them?
No, I just wrote them myself.
You wrote them?
Yeah.
No management?
No.
So what was the deal? A handshake? Okay. You're like, will you guys distribute this? Sure. Do I get any money? We'll see. Oh, sounds perfect. Take it.
No, I had a lawyer and oh, good. I did a deal. And, oh, good. You know,
good.
There was a negotiation.
Oh, good.
And
so it's real show business.
Yeah. I didn't just...
You didn't send them a handwritten letter.
I didn't just send them the beta tape and say, you know...
The beta tape.
Well, wish for the best.
Good. Well, that's good. So now, but this is your first special.
Yeah.
But you've done CDs or, yeah, I feel like you have.
I did a few CDs back in the day.
Few CDs back in the day.
Yeah.
Selling them at the club. Right?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, this was supposed to happen years before, supposed to, air quotes. You know, it was purchased by
the
Chill.
Special.
Yeah. Do you remember that company, Chill?
No.
Okay, so they made Maria's other special.
The one she did in front of her parents?
The one with the parents, yeah. which I love. Mm. And then they did like Ari Shaffir's and Greg Proops and stuff. And we had a deal with them. I was at Brillstein at the time. And then they folded. The whole company folded.
Chill was a production company.
Yeah. And then I was with Anonymous Content, and they were also making...
After Brillstein.
After Brillstein, I was with Anonymous, was making then a special with them. That didn't go through. And so... Now I just did it on my own.
You're a persevering woman.
Well, and I also feel like if it had happened at those times, it wouldn't have been the same special. It's a much better special now.
How so?
Well, at those times, it probably would have been a series of funny dating stories gone wrong, which are... always entertaining,
yeah.
but now there's a more thorough narrative arc, and I've learned more as a person, and this one's about healing trauma so that we don't continue to recreate it. And so,
yeah. Oh, really? So it's like an EMDR special?
It's a very...
Do you have to watch it? You have to move your head? Do you have to move your eyes when you watch it back and forth?
Someone should do that. That would be revolutionary. It actually is. It's about when I went to EMDR and
really?
Healed my trauma. Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Well, good.
And so it's. I feel like it's got a much stronger message now because I have more healing as a person.
Well, where'd you come from? Where did you because like when I got back here. In 2002, and I was desperately trying to, you know, plant myself here. You know, I wasn't really known. But you had a room early on, right?
Yeah.
Like, way early on. It was like a box, right? Was it in a mall?
It was a box. Exactly. It was a box in a mall. Let's see. I had several.
But wait, where'd you come from?
Okay, so I was born in Hutchinson, Kansas.
Kansas? You're like a Kansas person?
Yeah.
Where's Hutchinson?
Hutchinson is...
Hutchinson. Yeah.
Hutchinson or Hutch.
Hutch. Oh,
as the locals might refer to it.
When they say, how many high schools are in Hutchinson?
I don't actually know because we only lived there like 2 months.
So you got out.
Don't have a lot of info about it, but it's a small town in Kansas.
Right. So that's where you were born.
Mm-hmm.
And then where did you grow up?
Well, so we moved 27 times.
What the fuck? Military or just running away?
My dad...
Was he a criminal?
I would say both. My dad was military, he was Navy, and he was bipolar.
Ooh, exciting.
And he loved to move on a bipolar high.
My dad did that.
What?
Sure. Yeah.
Really? How many times?
When he destroyed his life and hit the road? I don't know. Let's see. I'm trying to think. So, started in Albuquerque. He was in Victoria, Texas, Warsaw, New York, Muscatine, Iowa. I don't remember. Like, there was at least 4 or 5 times where, and I used to track it. because, like, you know, him and my mom broke up, so he hit the road. He was a doctor, but he got kind of chased out of Albuquerque.
Chased out.
Like, I never got the full clear story, but I knew that he would get a job basically as an orthopedic surgeon in existing practices and do a year deal with them in these different places. So he wouldn't have to pay, you know, he'd have an office. He wouldn't, you know, he would just enter an existing practice in these other towns and then he'd stay there for a year. But it always sort of kind of, it was the arc of his cycle. Like, you know, by the time he left, I got the feeling that the town wanted him to leave. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was right around the time where the mania would kick in. He'd be writing letters to the newspaper and, you know, getting, you know. So I'm familiar with the manic compulsion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But your dad would say, like, I want a new life.
I don't even think it was that conscious. Mm. But I do think that's what it was, that he would say, we've got to go.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would be like that night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He'd be like, we're leaving in, you know, in the middle of the night.
How many kids were there?
Three.
That's crazy.
Was
he in trouble ever?
He was never in trouble that I know of.
So he wasn't like literally like, we got to get out before they get me.
No, it was just more like, I mean, he would have like a reason always, like job transfer, or I'm leaving this job, or I need to, there's a better job here, or, you know, something like that. But he loved to move. Like, I've never seen him happier than when we were
in the car,
moving
in motion.
Know? Yeah.
That freed feeling.
Yeah.
Starting over.
Well, you know how they call it? They call that a geograph.
Geographic.
Right? Geographic.
Yeah.
And so if you know, and people change their hair all the time, it's a hair geographic.
Oh, that's interesting. I never heard that.
And you want to change.
I've done some hair and clothing geographics in my time.
Sure. Me too.
Oh my God. But have you? You look exactly the same. for like 15 years.
Why are you yelling
at
me?
For like 15 years. I could tell you, I could see Melinda Hill from a half a mile away and know it was you.
Thank you.
It's a compliment.
I did do brown hair once.
And red hair. Big geographic. You didn't cut it though.
Really. I did chop it all off once when I was like 18.
Oh, okay. Before I knew.
Yeah.
Right. So, but fuck, you can watch all my Conans and see like, what's this guy got going on today? Haircuts. Outfits.
Did it change a lot? I feel like you look exactly the same.
I locked in at some point. I realized like it's time to commit to a thing. Well, I've had the mustache configuration for a while. I don't know if I had it when I met you. I don't think I had it when I got here. Maybe scruff, but not the mustache. I had long hair.
Okay, I don't remember the long hair. I feel like you've always...
I guess it was kind of short. You
look
right.
The same. I feel like you've always looked the same.
Yeah, I'll take it. I think it's about right.
Some people look drastically different from year to year.
Yeah, well, some people do the rebranding. You know, like, that guy's not working anymore. I need a new hook. You know, that guy, what's his name? You know, he's a comic. He was on a comic Last Standing, Chris. Tall guy. He used to be like, you know, he talks like this. He's from the South.
Chris Porter.
He went through full rebranding.
What's the rebrand?
Just like, you know, dark the horn rim glasses, short hair. No, like he's not like white trash Southern rock anymore. He's like a comedy nerd guy now.
Oh.
Full. He went full Jonah Ray.
Well, I guess we're allowed to evolve.
Of course. I'm a full believer. So, all right. So you're going from town to town. What was it? Yeah. What were the cycles? Like every year or tighter? It must have been tighter than that.
It really varied. We did live in 27 places. There were many schools.
It's so rough.
It was definitely rough. And I feel like my formative years, though, were spent in Colorado Springs, which I kind of think of as home.
Okay.
Even though I never visit.
Like high school?
Yeah, like, you know, ninth grade in there. And then we moved to a little town called Woodland Park, Colorado. And then we moved to Halstead, Kansas.
Back to Kansas.
When I was a junior in high school.
So you just kept pulling you out of high school, pulling you out of friends. So you're unable to really make bonds that lasted.
Exactly.
But like in terms of the bipolar situation, so your mom, was she just like a kind of codependent in this situation? Did she have did she have any sort of will or strength of her own in the face of this horrendous, I'm assuming, tornado of bipolarity?
No.
No.
She was married, yes, definitely codependent, married at 19, had me.
You're
shortly
the first,
thereafter.
You're the first?
I'm the oldest.
At 20 she had you?
Yeah, 19.
At 19.
Imagine having a child at 19.
My mom was 22. I can't figure it out.
And she had two subsequent children immediately, both my brothers. And, you know...
Was your dad still in the military?
No. My dad had returned from the Navy. He was like 26. He met my mom. Mm. And they were married. They had three children. Yeah. My mom was an orphan. Huh. She was orphaned at 6.
So she grew up in foster parents?
She was separated from her. She was one of 6 children. They were all separated at age 6 from their parents because her dad had PTSD, like shrapnel in his brain from the war. And so he couldn't care for the children. Mm. And he would forget to feed them, like stuff like that. And
so where was the mom?
The mom was there, but she, I guess, had emotional breakdown. I don't know if it was like...
Wow. So your mom lived with this family? This was her parents for 6 till she was 6?
So she was 6.
So she was wired for her future.
Exactly. And they were out like, you know, she was like one of the oldest, her and her sister. So they would like care for all the other kids. So they would like... have to steal food to eat like that level before they were taken away. Mm. And then they were, you know, separated into foster care. And
holy Christ.
She tells like the story that like they were in this orphanage and the highlight of the kid's day was like when this policeman would come around on his beat to the window and like do like a funny dance for the kids. Like they would gather around the window and like wait for this policeman.
Exciting. Live entertainment.
Yeah. His first open mic. Anyway, so she was eventually adopted and by a very abusive alcoholic. She ran away at 16.
Oh my
with her
God.
Brother.
The two of them were adopted?
Yeah. They were adopted together by abusive alcoholics, and the alcoholic woman would just beat them up every night. I mean, this was before they knew about child abuse and stuff. And
they knew about it.
And but you know, kids, they don't know like we're supposed to report this.
No,
you know,
of course
especially
not. Right,
being
right.
adopted.
Right.
So at one point, my mom was 16. Her brother was 15. Her brother was getting, you know, beaten up or whatever, and he ran out the door to the police station.
Yeah.
And my mom ran after him.
Yeah.
And they were taken out of that home, and my mom went to live with her friend, and then she met my dad, like, you know, 2 years later.
Oh, my God. And he's back from the Navy, and he's got the bipolar.
Well, nobody knows that he has bipolar until years later. So my whole childhood, it was unmedicated.
So, like, well, did he go down? Like, I mean, like, depressed?
Yeah. Yeah. He would get, like, really depressed. And he was from, like, the good family in the town. So my mom was, like, really excited to be with him and a part of this great family. Because my mom, like,
in
Kansas. Halstead, Kansas.
Yeah.
All she ever wanted was, like, to be a part of a great family.
But
right?
He's from Halstead?
He's from Halstead,
Kansas. But Hutchinson is just where you were born.
Right. So Halstead is close to Hutchinson.
Right.
Maybe it's like an hour away. But Halstead has brick streets.
Right. So he come from like an old family in Kansas, rich family?
They're not rich, but they were very well respected, the hills of Halstead,
The hills
Kansas.
Of Halstead.
Yes. And you know, all the there were 9 children, Catholic. Wow. And they were all like the star athletes of the school.
How many cousins do you have?
A million. I don't even know. Hundreds.
Do you know them?
No.
None of them?
I mean, yes, of course, I know them and remember them from many gatherings through my childhood. And my grandma always had like these fabulous gatherings with all the, you know, cousins and stuff. Right. But I'm not close.
So this is like, not that I'm psychoanalyzing, but I mean, this is like kind of rough to get any footing in the old sense of self, I imagine. Just kind of a walking, untethered vessel.
That's the name of my next special. Walking, untethered vessel. Wow. Yeah, truly. Truly. Yes, you're right.
And you wandered out here somehow.
Yes, I untethered. I blew in here from Kansas, like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Untethered.
Looking for someone to tether you.
Yeah. Looking to...
For show business, to tether you.
Yeah, looking to the most untetherable business in the world.
To parent you.
Yes, like so many others.
I know. I know. But what was that like? So, like, are your siblings all right?
They are great,
Mark. Oh, that's
Mark.
Good. That's good. That's
you
a good story.
You look very concerned.
No, I'm serious. Like, because, you know, you think of the three, like, coming from depression and that kind of stuff, and talking to so many people, it is nice to know that, you know, people get out. It's a good, you know, not only you, but that they're doing okay.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It's inspiring.
Did you take the hit for them?
What do you mean?
I mean, were you, well, I mean, you're the oldest.
Yes.
So, like, were you more aware of, like, the insanity? Were you protective of them? Like...
I was. It's really hard to, you know, live in that and want to protect everyone. And I definitely, like, wanted to, protect my mom and my brothers. Mm. It was a very turbulent household. So, you know, I definitely wanted to be able to do that. And I kind of, like, grew up kind of getting my validation in life by being people's counselor, you know,
hearing people out and supporting people like your mom sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Was like always trying, you know, to save my mom and help her. And
what was it? Was your father abusive or just out of his mind?
Both. He was a rager.
Oh, yeah.
So
I know that one. That's, I think that's why you always had a natural aversion to me.
What?
You're like, that guy's, he's a monster in there. I can see a monster.
I've never had a natural aversion to you, Mark. Okay. What are you talking about? Right. Is this an imagined?
Maybe. Maybe it's slightly imagined.
Are
but
you projecting?
No, not really. Not really. I was a rager when I was younger.
Yeah.
So I understand it.
Well, it's familial, right? So it's passed down.
My old man, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's horrible. It's horrible. I mean, it's certainly, you know, a lot of what, you know, because I associate you with my ex-wife. So, and, you know, that was much of the reason why she left me, you know, was because of that. So, like, I'm familiar with it.
Mm.
And I know the damage that it can cause because it's just so, it's so, like, especially with bipolar is like you can't help them when they're depressed. They'll drain you that way. And then when they're manic and they're raging around, then they just, you can't be close to them because they're going to hurt you. Right. So you're just, your whole sense of self gets all shattered.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just really unpredictable. I mean, right. It's so predictable, but
you don't know when it's going to.
Yeah.
Happen.
So he would be like the most charismatic person in the world. Mm. And then alternately very depressed and sad. Just like a
black hole. Like,
not talking to anyone, only speaking to the pets.
And they get that horrible look in their eye when they're depressed. That kind of like, there's an almost kind of lostness.
Inconsolable.
Ugh,
gone. Not even there. Like there, but not there.
Right.
And then alternately... extreme rage, like throwing the vacuum, like war zone.
Oh, man. Sorry you went through that.
Thank you.
So when
and
you...
And not physically abusive, though, thankfully.
That's lucky, though a little trickier to address the trauma.
It is, because it's subtle.
Yeah, and it's like a period of trauma. Like, I find, especially with EMDR, that if you have an event that you can start with and move through, that's like, that seems to be really the good way to do it. But if you're just sort of like, well, my whole childhood. Okay, so that's a lot.
That's a long therapy session. Did you do EMDR too?
I have.
Okay.
I do it now.
What was your experience? What's your experience?
Well, my buddy Steve is one of the big guys, practitioners of it. Steve Danziger. You know Steve?
No.
He's my sponsor, but he's also, you know, my friend.
Cool.
And he got hip to it a few years back. So he actually teaches EMDR. So he kind of, he told me about it and he showed me how it worked. But lately I've been, you know, seeing a therapist who does it, a friend of his, this woman, you know, in processing, you know, the Lynn's death, you know, and that, you know, specifically, you know, like last week or a week or so ago, going through that last week of her life here. You know, here.
Oh my gosh. When,
not knowing that she was dying. And then looking back at it after she passed, you know, and my place and the, you know, the weight of that. We reprocessed that twice. You know, the second time a couple of weeks ago, and it definitely helps.
Do you feel lighter or you feel like, how is it making you feel?
Well, I mean, it's really about, like you said, you know, once you, whether you believe in the hocus pocus of it or not, because I think that EMDR is an uphill battle, is, come on, with the buzzers and the this and that, yeah, however you're going to do it, right?
Yeah.
It seems a little crackpotty.
Right.
But there is some science there, and they're having a lot of success with vets and PTSD and stuff. So for me, once I understood that the agenda was to kind of like open up whatever the, I don't know, do you know exactly how it works?
I think, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's been described to me something like, you take the traumatic memory that you're currently reacting to and reacting from that space in your life, the historical trauma, and you take it and you process it in real time with this eye movement stuff, and it puts it into the right drawer in your brain.
Yeah.
So you're no longer reacting from that space.
You're not constantly re-traumatizing yourself.
Right. Or perceiving circumstances to be historical.
Right. So the eye movement thing or the buzzers kind of, you know, distract the brain in a way that you can pull this stuff out of your reptilian or animal brain where trauma plants itself.
Yeah.
And move it into the more cognizant thing. Kind of like almost spread it out or something.
Yeah. And I think just processing those emotions of grief, of anger, of sadness, of fear.
Yeah, I like it. The process where you start with the thing and then you do the buzzers or the eye movement and then you're like, where are you at now?
Yeah.
And you kind of go through that like five or six times until you see where you end up.
Yeah.
Even that process without buzzers or eye movement would be good.
Yeah.
But with it, to answer your question, like I kind of was compulsively going over all the things that happened.
Yeah.
That week. Not so much that I felt like I didn't do what I could, but I didn't know she was dying.
Mm.
So, you know, in retrospect, you're sort of like, that maybe I should have taken her. Like, it's not a lot of shoulda, woulda, coulda, because what she had would have done her in anyways. But there are moments where like they're just, you know, they just, you keep going back and you keep, so by reprocessing it, it seems to have subsided a little. I don't revisit it.
That's really powerful to not be in that loop, because that is that's, I believe that's what it's coming up for healing, right? So in doing this process, it's healing.
Right. So clearly what we're talking about is like a long period of different types of trauma, right?
Yeah. You know, what started happening was I started kind of hiding, like going underground, like wanting to have, you know, do my career and getting this acting work and stuff. But I would start like hiding. There was something inside of me like undermining me, like trying to stay hidden where it just felt safe. And
like isolating?
Yeah, like, you know, I had Tiger Lily, and it was like crowded every week, and we'd have these great lineups. And
yeah, you started that room with Maria.
Maria Bamford.
And was it just you two?
It was Maria Bamford, Natasha Leggero.
And you.
And me at Los Feliz.
In Los Feliz at the Cuban restaurant?
Yeah. I thought it would be a weekly show that would last like a month, and it just ran for 10 years. It had a life of its own.
Right. So it's, well, maybe we'll back up and back in and then drive into the trauma. So when do you... When do you run away from home?
So I left home 3 days after high school, so 18 years old.
So you were like fucking done. As soon as you could.
Yes. I had to go. Mm. And I did feel guilty. I didn't want to leave my brothers there, but I had to go.
Mm. And you came here?
No. So because we had been moved from Colorado Springs, where all of my friends were and my boyfriend and stuff, I wanted to go back and be with them for that summer. So I told my mom, I'm going to Colorado Springs for the summer with no intent of ever coming back. But she didn't know that.
Right.
So I went to Colorado Springs to try to, you know, be with all my friends. Well, they've all moved on. High school's over. They're all going to college, you know. Yeah. And so I'm just there, like the loneliest feeling in the world, like trying to.
Oh, my God. So you go back to get some. I'm going to go back home where my friends are. And they're like, and you're knowing.
I'm
going to
get
everyone's
my teen years back.
Oh,
and they're gone.
Sad story.
Everyone's moved on.
Wow.
So I took this weird nanny job. I had a scholarship. I had a theater scholarship to Wichita State University. And I was like, well, I'm going to take 6 months off and take this weird nanny job.
Why is it weird?
It paid like $200 a month.
Not much. And you lived at the house?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I took care of these four children.
Four?
And I was like I was 18.
Crazy. Were the parents weird?
No, I mean, it was a sweet woman. She was a flight attendant.
Oh, okay.
She was always gone. But I think I just took it in the moment because I needed like a place to stay. And then I just ended up staying there for like the whole semester. And then I was like, what am I doing? I need to go to school. And I moved back and took my scholarship.
So you went from taking care of your siblings to taking care of strange kids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wouldn't call them strange. They were sweet. But
the caretaker role followed you around.
Right. And I'm,
So you go to Wichita?
Yeah, so I go to Wichita.
And you get your theater degree.
I do a bunch of plays and a bunch of writing classes. And that's where I got like a lot of, I mean, I had already been doing plays for years.
So you went for 4 years? You did the whole thing?
No, I did a year there and I did a year at KU in Lawrence.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did you get a degree or no?
No.
Fuck it.
I
got some skills.
I did some writing classes, got some skills, and then I came here and went to acting school.
Where?
Joanne Barron.
Joanne Barron. She's still around?
I believe so.
Hmm. Was there famous people? Who were her famous people?
Her famous people were like Robin Wright Penn. Mm. That's all I can think of.
they all have one.
No, I'm sure there are many. I don't. Did you go to acting school?
I did not go to acting school, but I did study some acting with Mark Howard in New York briefly.
Okay.
I took it here and there, but I never. I would never say I studied for very long.
Do you feel that it helped you, or you didn't really need it because you always just play yourself, right?
Now wait a minute. I think that I'm a nuanced actor that does different variations. That didn't land well.
Well, I feel like a lot of comedians are such good actors and dramatic actors as well. And then some really they're just straight comedy, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really do any acting until much later. I mean, it didn't really, you know, it was really here and there. And I never saw it. I never tried to do it because I always believed that at some point there were people better at sitcoms than me. I can't do it. So
I feel like you're great. I think you're great in GLOW.
Yeah, but that was like 4 years ago, right? So I was 50-something years old. I mean, that's really the first acting job I really had was doing Marin.
I feel like, though, that's...
My late 40s.
But that's perfect.
No, I'm not complaining.
It's like divine timing.
Yeah, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that none of it was going to happen, and it didn't happen, and I guess my point was I never really put myself out there to be an actor. I couldn't handle it.
Right.
Because like I have so much invested in my own work to go and do like mediocre scripts and have this garbage come out of your mouth and have that be your life and worry about whether you can deliver the garbage well. I mean, it's like, fuck it.
Yeah.
And I don't even think I don't even think I had representation for a decade. I mean, I think Dave Becky used to tell me that I had representation, but I really don't think I did.
What's that mean?
I just don't think I had an agent. I think I had, every once in a while he'd get somebody to do him a favor and send me out a few times until I didn't get anything. And then, but I just stopped fucking worrying about it.
Yeah. Well, that's when things happen, right?
No, that wasn't.
Stop worrying about it.
When things happen is when I fired Dave Becky. I lost everything. Mishna left me, crushed my life. I had nothing. Mm. And I didn't know what was going to happen. That's when it happened. Not when I gave up. That's when it happened, where I'm like, I guess it's not going to work out. That's when it happened. Not when I'm like, I don't give a fuck. But I seriously was just sort of like, it's over, and I'm going to have to figure something out.
I've had such similar experiences of just giving up.
Oh, yeah.
And then there it is, you know?
Right.
But it's just giving up that plan and being like, okay, I guess this isn't going to be a thing.
Well, yeah, but you've had so many things and so many things that went for a while, that almost went. I mean, so like, when did it start? I mean, because like, there's things you created that went for a while.
Yeah.
Like, when did all that start happening? I mean, you've been plugging along.
I have been plugging along. I mean, I guess, you know, after acting school, they have a little consultation at the end. And my teacher was like, I think you should go into comedy. You're accidentally funny. Mm. You're doing these serious scenes. And
now
everyone's
we just have
laughing.
To figure out how to do it on purpose. Good luck with that.
That's my next special, Accidentally Funny.
Yeah.
So I went to the Groundlings.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I completely... I mean, I had never even really seen stand-up at this point. My brother was a huge comedy fan.
Uh-huh.
But I went through the Groundlings. I learned how to write sketches.
Were you ever in the company?
No. So I advanced through all the levels to the very tip-top level.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that precipice right before you go into Sunday Company, I, along with 10 other people in our 12-person class, were cut.
Oh,
devastating. And it was a very talented, tremendously talented group. It was like Mikey Day, who's on SNL now.
The guys who got cut?
Brian Keith Etheridge. Well, Mikey was I think they told him to repeat. And Brian Keith Etheridge, who's a big TV writer, and Kristen Wiig.
Mm.
And it was like a great group. But at that point, I was cut from there. And I was devastated.
Mm.
Just, I mean, imagine like spending like every night going to these shows and taking all the classes and writing all these sketches.
Working towards this thing.
Working towards a thing and really putting your heart and soul in this basket. And,
holy shit.
And then the basket gets up and walks away.
Ugh.
So.
First lesson in show business.
What's the lesson?
It's not necessarily meritocracy. It doesn't end well for many people. And it's filled with rejection.
That's right. And so at that time, first I was like, I'm quitting acting.
Oh, yeah?
I'm quitting acting.
Yeah, where are you going to go?
Forget it.
Where are you going to go?
It's over.
We can go
end
back
of the
to
road
Kansas?
Here. Yeah, I guess. Is Kansas hiring? I don't know.
The state? Yeah. I'd like to apply to Kansas.
Kansas, do you remember me?
Is
it too late? I'm sorry I left.
That's your next one-person show. There's a lot of titles are coming up during this episode.
Kansas, this is a title
do you
special.
Still remember me? That's a book. That's not a comedy special. That's a book. So didn't quit acting.
I did quit, and I took a job at waitressing, and I... Out of the blue, this agent called me, and they're like, we saw you at the Groundling show.
Oh, great. They dragged you back in.
And they're like, we just put a voiceover booth in. We think you'd be great at voiceovers.
Uh-huh.
So I went in and auditioned for this voiceover.
Yeah.
I booked it.
Yeah.
It ran 4 years.
Oh, my God.
It won the Emmy for Outstanding Commercial.
Really?
And...
You made some money.
And I found out I got the job while I was in the bank... For identity theft. I found out I'd been identity thefted with all these checks. So I'm like waitressing at this job, maybe like 13 a night. I've quit acting. I've got these checks that people have washed my checks that I dropped in the Los Feliz post office. And I'm in there sorting that out. My agent calls, who sent me on one audition, and they're like, you booked it. And I just thought it was like a spec thing. I was going to pay like $50. And it was like this giant commercial campaign for Citibank.
Wow. And how many spots did you do?
That was it. It was the OG original Citibank spot with the guy sitting in the recliner, and he's had his identity stolen by a valley girl, and that was me going like, first I emptied the checking account there in the Vinte was a sexy little outfit, you know, that thing.
Yeah. I
just
remember
had
that.
To have it, that thing. Yeah. So that like ran, and then I was started doing stand up because I was like, well,
that thing ran a long time, right? That commercial
ran 4 years.
But that was back in the day where you made a little money on that shit.
Yeah, you made a lot of great money on those campaigns. And then I was doing stand-up, and there was an agent in the audience from ICM Voice. So I got signed to ICM Voice, and then I was like working all the time in voiceover. So that happened right after saying I'm never acting again.
Voiceover, that's where you, that was the secret. Because I was always sort of like, what does Melinda Hill do? I know she's doing stand-up over here, but like, what, does she go on the road? What does she do? Voiceover. Yeah, the secret voiceover life.
Yeah, I was doing, I've done a lot of voiceover. And then the Groundling stuff really came in handy because it was like using all those characters and voices. And then I started doing those in my act. And then, and then I got on Adventure Time cartoon.
You did a lot of episodes of that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Did you do it too?
I did one episode. But it seems like they called you back all the time. You did a bunch of characters?
I did a few, like, I don't know, five. And then, like, when Maria Bamford was doing her show, they just would hire me to fill in for her voices.
Really?
Yeah, when she was doing it.
She's on Adventure Time a lot?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Maria does so much voice stuff.
Oh, really? I didn't realize.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of voice stuff? It seems like you would.
I don't. I do. I have done lately. I did a flying squirrel on Adventure Time. In voiceovers, they're not looking for me to have a lot of range. They want me to be what I am, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've just done two movies that are roughly different degrees of me. Like, I don't do much of this, you know.
I don't do that voice.
No, I don't do it. I don't do any of this. Oh, no, please don't.
But they're like, we went
the cranky guy. We got a cranky snail.
Yeah, I offered you a part in my series as the angry guy.
Yeah.
And you were like, I can't do it. And then TJ Miller did it.
Oh, good. Lucky you. I'm so glad. So when do... Now, we're skipping over some of the gossipy stuff. We're skipping over personal life stuff because I remember there's a lot of trauma in the world. Like, the world was small enough back then to where, like, when you broke up with what's-his-name and went with the what's-her-name, that there was, like, a big... There was a rupture in the community.
What?
It's like, what? She's not going out with what's-his-name and she's going out with her? When did this happen? Do you remember?
No, what are you talking about?
I just remember Dylan.
Oh, Dylan, yeah.
Like, you were with Dylan, and he was sort of a comic, right, or an actor?
Dylan was not a comic. He was a very talented filmmaker.
But he was always with you.
He was he was great.
And then, but I don't know how public you are about whatever. It seems like you are. Are you?
About?
Because are you public about the secret society?
I mean, I feel like it helps people.
Me too. So I used to see, you know, him or at certain secret society meetings, because I'd go to both of them, because I was with Double Winner. I was doing the codependent thing and the AA thing.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're not with Dylan anymore, and then you're with Tig. And everyone was like, she's with Tig? When did that happen? That went on for like years though, right?
No, I was with Dylan about, and there's some time lapse issues
my narrative?
In your narrative.
I'm sorry, I didn't keep up with you as fully as I should.
You didn't keep the best tabs, but
what?
Yeah, I was with Dylan about 2.5 years.
Right.
And then I left. We broke up, yeah. And I left the secret societies, and I started drinking.
Oh, how long had you had sober?
Several years at that point.
So how was it fun to start drinking again?
It actually was so fun.
Yeah, this is really helping other people. Not only does the secret society not work, but it's fun to drink.
No, it definitely was really fun until it wasn't anymore. Mm. And now I definitely prefer not drinking personally for me.
Are you back in the game?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And when did... 8. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I got 21.
You're winning.
No.
You're
one
winning.
Wins.
That's
no
amazing.
One no one wins. It's just a day, man. Yeah. We just got today. So yeah. So when did the take thing happen? Are we just going over that?
Well, I mean, what have you heard? I'll fact check.
I haven't heard anything. I just remember like we were all sort of excited and intrigued that Melinda Hill is with Tig Notaro. And like a lot of us are like, wow, Tig's got game. She's a player, man. Melinda, how does it work? What's happening?
People need answers. Oh my gosh, so funny. Well, that happened about, I guess around that time. Yeah, Dylan and I broke up. I'd always had a boyfriend doing stand-up.
Yeah.
I was with Dylan the whole time, so I was never throwing out some single vibe or anything.
Right.
And then I started having drinks at shows.
Yeah.
And then I started, traveling around the world, having drinks in other countries, trying all the drinks.
Yeah.
And
good.
Having the Mai Tai in Hawaii, having the,
Yeah, you really got around, huh?
Having the sake in Japan.
Nice.
Having the hot toddy in London. Why not?
How is all that happening?
Well, because I was like doing tours. We were doing tours for troops.
Oh, with Tig.
No, I was on separate stand-up tours.
Oh, okay.
And then while I was on a tour for troops across all of the South Pacific, I was offered a job in London doing that show, World Stands Up, where they fly the comedians in from around the world.
And how did these go for you?
The tours?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the ultimate service, being of service, bringing comedy to people on islands, mm-hmm. and where, they are starved for entertainment, mm-hmm. and morale. So in that sense, it's really wonderful.
When do you start this isolating thing? Like, was this a couple years ago where you start to have these symptoms of buried trauma or...
Yes, yeah, I'm doing Tiger Lily. It's moved to the Gower Gulch. It's in that little corner of the Gower Gulch.
Yeah. No, I did it. I did it several times.
Yeah, you were there several times. And it got really popular. It was like packed every week with these amazing comedians.
Yep.
And I found myself just... like I would drive to go there and I either wouldn't put myself on the lineup or I would just drive home. I found myself starting to hide. I was like hiding.
I kind of remember that. Like you'd be there at the beginning and it was sort of like, oh, that's her show. It's your show. And then you'd go.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I just started to...
Retreat.
Mm. And I started... What was happening with my writing was I started a storytelling show before that show. And I would start telling these stories. And then it was like that. The stuff from the childhood that I had basically blocked out my whole life, like I don't even remember most of my childhood, started to come out in these stories.
Before the same night as Tiger Lily. I remember, yeah.
I think I did
one of those.
Did you? Yeah. It was a great place to get new material.
Right.
And that's more my style, is more storytelling.
Sure.
And so I would get to generate a lot of material in the most no-press way, in a way that you couldn't really do on Tiger Lily anymore, because
right.
it was just such, so many people were there. So I started to do these stories that were like really honest and vulnerable, and I think people were scared for me, because I was starting to tell the truth on stage. It was coming out.
About your childhood.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was just coming up.
Were you crying on
healed.
Stage?
I mean, I think at one...
That's generally the point of concern when people are at a comedy show and the entertainer's crying. It's usually where they're like, is she okay? think she's crying.
I definitely did cry once. I definitely started crying.
On a storytelling show, so it's okay. You got a little, a little bit of room to cry in a storytelling show.
But it was like, what's going on? Mm. And I feel like it was just a need to...
get the work done.
Get some work done.
So you found a therapist.
Yeah, and I was like, had gotten, become a regular at the Comedy Store around that time. And I stopped drinking again and started going to therapy.
So that was 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So you drank for a while.
Yeah. Mm.
You went through a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Relationships. Weirdness. And you also did your codependent thing.
Yeah.
So now you've, 8 years ago, you kind of locked back in, got sober.
Yeah.
You doing both? Double wintering it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I definitely need the help with relationships and letting others do their thing. I'll do my thing.
Without your help? Without your trying to control them and help them?
Exactly. I needed help to stop being a counselor because that's not my job. And I'm not even that great at it. My clients are dying.
They're just gone. And they're not dying.
Yeah.
But this was sort of the beginning of the process of... dealing with your past, dealing with the trauma, and putting together this special.
Yeah, when I went to EMDR, you know, they uncovered the memories. And there was, like, a memory from my childhood that, like, basically, my dad had these rages, and it was really scary. And none of us knew that this was, like, something he could get help for or anything like that. But I tried to tape record it on a little tape. Remember those old school, like...
Yeah, the Panasonics?
And I tried to take
it. We got hit the both buttons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was, like, you know, really young, 4 or 5, and I tried to tape record this rage and, like, smuggle it out of the house to the next, like, big family gathering.
You're just going
to
play it around? Just walk around with
it? I was just going to see if anyone was interested in representing us with this tape. And, and so I, and then I made copies and I was selling it later at comedy shows. No, I'm kidding. So I'm walking around my grandma's.
I think I got one of those. It's called Dad's Mad.
Is that the name? It's a hit. So I tried to leave it at my grandma's just as a cry for help that someone would like save us. And, yeah. No one ever found it.
Oh, wow.
And so that was a memory in EMDR. And then I later was like so scared someone would find it that I went to my grandma's being like, you know that tape I left here? It was a joke.
Right.
Trying to cover up what was happening. I didn't want anyone to get in trouble.
Right.
Huh. My grandma's like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
So that was the beginning of, that was the portal into the trauma was that story.
That's a story that we worked on. Mm. And there was so much in there of like believing that your voice doesn't matter, that you aren't going to make any impact. Mm. So you might as well be quiet. Mm. No one's going to save you. Mm. Like that there's no help.
Right.
And so like processing all of that and then just like you can see how that would play out.
Right.
In,
sure.
You know, career stuff is like...
And everything, sure.
You're not going... You don't matter.
Right.
No one's going to help.
Right.
So, like, really processing that and, like, that and several other similar things has made a huge difference.
It's great. And then also having friends like Maria, supportive people.
Oh, my God. Maria's the best. Margaret Cho.
Cho's helping out, too.
The best.
Great.
You know, just to be able to call people and say, like, how do you do this? I don't know. Like, what do you charge for this? Like, how did you make this happen? And Maria's the best because she'll just be like, you know.
Practical.
She's like, do it in your living room. It doesn't fucking matter, you know? Like, and so a lot of this, like, running the special, I would just say, I'm running my special tonight at 6 p.m. in my living room. And people would come and watch. And I would take notes. What resonated with you? What were you enjoying? And so it was really like...
That is specifically a Maria process.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of amazing how she does that, how you guys have made... That it's actually a practical system that you were able to use. Is like, why not do it like that? You know, I mean, you know, connecting's connecting. And if you're sort of completely reliant on, oh, I got to go to the theater, I got to rent this. I mean, she just solicits people on Twitter to sit with her for an hour.
Maria doesn't care. She used to hire me just to listen to her new jokes, which was the best job. And I would just drive over to Eagle Rock and listen to her jokes. And she would do that from the road sometimes. And now, yeah, she just meets people on Twitter. And she really...
She'll buy them lunch.
Yeah, she'll buy them lunch. And she'll just... What that does is it simplifies the process, you know, of like... You know, instead of spending all this time promoting an appearance, you're going to have to make all this money to pay back or whatever. How about just focus on the material?
Right.
And so anyway, so that's a lot of how it came together, in addition to doing like a million spots everywhere.
Well, that's very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And wait, what's this movie?
Oh, so yeah, I did a movie called Love, Weddings, and Other Disasters. And that is starring... Diane Keaton, Jeremy Irons. It's coming out December 4th.
Big part?
It's one of my first lead roles in a film.
Wow, with those big hitters. So were you doing scenes with both of them?
No, they had their scenes. it's four different storylines.
Oh, okay.
So I'm in a completely separate storyline.
Okay.
We filmed it in Boston for a month.
Wow.
And it was a wonderful shoot. Boston's a great town, as I'm sure you know. It's a really great script. It was a really fun part.
And where's that going to be on?
That'll be COVID pending. I don't know what the premiere will entail.
Yeah.
But it will be everywhere, released from Saban Entertainment on December 4th.
Okay.
I had to do a Russian accent.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you do that? Did you buy a tape?
You know, Dennis said, don't do that. So it was really kind of unlearning what I'd done in the audition because I was doing a very funny character, like from Barry type Russian accent. And so it was sort of unlearning that and making her a very real person who's like authentic. I got to use my Meisner.
Great. Did they have a dialect coach?
No.
Nothing.
They did send me to a trainer. So I worked out with a personal trainer because there were a lot of stunts and things that I had to do.
What's
like
this character?
A lot going on in this movie. I am a Russian girl, Svetlana, who is trying to escape from her dark and sordid life involving the Russian mafia.
Huh.
And... you know, it's really funny, but, you know, she's really needs to get out.
Heavy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And.
But funny.
It's heavy and funny. Yeah.
And what have you been doing during lockdown? Are you doing voice stuff?
No. I mean, some voice stuff will come through.
Are you alone over there with the cat?
I'm alone with Stardust, and I've been writing a lot. I've been writing a self-help book, and... I'm writing a movie.
What's the angle of the self-help book?
You've
decided you can help people now? Like you've taken up the mantle again? You've got enough recovery. You're like, maybe I'm not so bad at helping people.
Maybe I should revisit that counselor position. No, it's really just things that have helped me about like self-love and empowerment and...
So it's on the level. It's not funny.
It's going to be funny as shit, but still like helpful. It's kind of like it's a self-help vibe though.
Okay.
But I'm not pretending to be an expert in anything. I'm just sharing what's helped me.
Right.
And that's what the special is really doing too, is like I'm really just trying to help free people from their abusive stories about themselves because they're just not true.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bad, we created bad self parents when we were younger.
Yeah.
You have bad parents, but when you're younger, you don't. This is what I learned that changed my life in the last 5 years, maybe or so, is that when you don't get what you need from your parents, you assume it's your fault. And you put in place a fairly, probably negative self parenting system. because you think you're shitty, because you don't feel loved, or you feel whatever they're doing, emotional abuse, physical abuse, you know, however, neglect, overbearing, whatever it is, if you don't feel good in your skin when you're a kid, it can't be their fault, because they're amazing. They're your parents. So it must be you.
Exactly. And that
bad
leads...
Bad narrative. Yeah.
Very bad. Well... destructive narrative, mm-hmm. and it leads to so many things, right? When you're trying to prove your worth all the time, mm-hmm. or for me, it became workaholism. Like, if I just mm-hmm. achieve more things, mm-hmm. then I'm going to be good enough, or I'm going to, you know, and it's like not it when really it's like that radical self-love is just knowing like you're enough, like you have inherent value, mm-hmm. not contingent on any exterior. And that's what probably people with nurturing parents, that's yeah. probably the message they receive.
Those
but
fucking
since
people. They can
motherfuckers,
go fuck themselves.
They'll never be a comedian.
Never. They're just going to accept their dumb, boring lives. Not like us just tumbling through it.
Notice me. Notice me.
Yeah. Will you
Is
be my
Is this enough? Is this enough? And so it's just, you know, they say enlightenment is yeah. unlearning things. So enlightenment is really unlearnment.
Unlearnment.
It's unlearning all that.
Is that a chapter in the book?
Could be.
Better write that down.
That's the next special.
A lot of specials. You got a lot of specials to do.
But, about Tig, we were just friends.
Okay.
And then we started dating.
Okay. That's fun though, right? You guys seem to have a good time.
We had a great time. Mm. And,
I'm really selling it.
And, you know, but when you're drinking, the sure. best of times, the worst of times.
I hear you, man. But everybody's doing good.
Oh my gosh.
Everyone's doing okay.
I love her. I'm so grateful for our friendship. We did, I did her little comedy festival a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, she's great.
She's solid.
She's solid.
Always was.
And Dylan's great too.
Oh, good. You
Dylan's
guys are friends
amazing.
Too?
No, we're not. But,
he's doing okay, huh?
But Dylan is, he's amazing, you know?
Yeah.
And he's doing great. Yes, he's doing great. He has a wife.
Good.
She looks exactly like me.
Wow. He just never let
I'm
it
kidding.
Go.
I'm kidding. No, she's beautiful and they have a beautiful baby and I paid him back the money I owed him and everything.
So you know all
good.
This stuff, but he doesn't like you. You know all this stuff and you're not friends. That's a little concerning. You check it
well,
up.
Well, I mean, how friendly can you be with people who are
you're asking the wrong guy.
Who are married with children, you know.
What do you mean? Like
you're respectful.
You put
from
my ex on your fucking podcast specifically to cause trouble.
What? Wow. Okay.
You want to work it out? You want to
yes, please.
Deal with the resentment?
Yes. Yes, you have a resentment?
No, not really.
I would love to know about that. Did that hurt your feelings?
You have to understand something. That woman, I've not seen her since 2007. So I've not seen her since we got divorced. Zero. Right, like nothing. Never ran into her. I would email her. I tried to make an amends, which she didn't really take.
Okay. What do you mean she didn't take it?
Well, we were going to meet, and then she called me 20 minutes before and said, I can't fucking do this. You know, if you want to do it on the phone, let's do it. I'm like, I don't. So then I wrote her something. But, like, I can't account for... Like, I can make an amends, but if somebody brings me up to her, or she's still attached to me when on a Google search or something, that's not me. You know what I mean? And I just tried to not talk about her anymore, which I'm breaking my rule, but because I still think it bothers me. But I used to email her on my sober birthday every year and thank her for getting me sober.
Okay.
Which she never responded to.
Okay.
Until like a couple of years ago, she just said, if I want to hear from you, I'll let you know. And then I realized why. So she's like, still aggressively Al-Anoned. But it was a great. It was like a.
Have you ever had amends, like, Have you had more people not want an amends, or is that the only one?
You can do an amends, but it doesn't mean they have to accept it.
Right.
And she's got, look, she, all her reasoning is fine, but you're curious, you know, after a certain point.
Of course.
You know, it's a weird thing. But that moment was very important to me because I realized, like, oh, I'm that fucking idiot. Everyone's got that person that when you see them come up on your phone after a year, you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
What does that person want? when you realize that, like, I'm that guy.
Yeah.
I'm that guy. Like, yeah, she's got her whole other, like, she's really framed our thing as, like, this, not a mistake necessarily, but it's like, we don't have kids. There's not, you know, whatever the divorce, all that. But it's, it has nothing to do with her life anymore. She's got pretty babies. She's got a nice life, I guess. And I'm just like this mistake or this process, this whatever. So that's that. I mean, I can accept all that. Yeah, really. But there's always curiosity. Like, I would love to run into her.
Yeah.
But she would still hate me. But whatever. I would still just like to see her face.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
I know.
It's been over a decade. You friends with her?
I am friends with Mishna. I don't see her often.
Mm.
Because, you know, she has her whole life.
Yeah.
And she's very busy.
Wrote a movie.
Yeah. I think she's written a few now.
Yeah. I know people are in her new movie, the comic book one, or the one that's based on a video game or something.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's a horror. No, that's right. You're right. And yeah. But that's so great. I just remember her always working so hard.
Yeah.
As and comedy. And so it's so great to see her doing all that. I don't see hardly anyone very often.
Well, no
anymore.
One's seen anybody anymore.
Yeah. What was your beef with the podcast?
No, nothing. It was just like at that time, because like there was still like, you know, it took me a long time to sort of process all that.
Yeah.
So I just made it about me. I'm like, why the fuck are they? I know Jillian. Why is Jillian Melinda? What do they got to talk to Mishna for? Because there was some suggestion of me.
Oh, really?
During the conversation.
What was it? This is so long
ago. I know. It was just sort of like, well, you know who I'm talking about. That kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Like, I went out with a comic. It was just some veiled reference. I'm like, what? But in my mind, I'm like, this is about me. It's all about me. Yeah. But it was nothing about me.
No. And we would never want to, like, I'm friends with both of you, so I would never want to, disparage. And I don't know enough about anyone's relationship. I mean, but I guess everyone feels like that, right? Like, I feel like that when I break up with public figures.
Yeah.
People are going to be taking sides and,
you know. Well, there wasn't like, she just left comedy, really, and just became a writer, which is, I think, what she wanted to do anyways. But that's another thing. I should do some EMDR on that.
I think it would be helpful because, you know, and I don't know how, did you guys try couples counseling?
It was like a Hail Mary pass.
Okay. Is it too late to revisit that? I'm kidding. but I was in couples counseling one time and they said, you know, when you guys are in a relationship, it's their parents, it's your parents are all in the relationship with you. So you're just like acting out of your triggers or whatever. And yeah, we keep recreating that until it's healed, right? So
yeah,
EMDR would probably be.
I just like, it's not active anymore, and I really do have a lot of acceptance around it. But it wouldn't be bad to sort of, like, when I think about the, like, you know, that moment of like I'm leaving. That like when she walked out of that kitchen, and that was it. That's heavy.
You didn't see it coming.
No, I'm a fucking moron.
Yeah, and you have, like, I have a very rumination mind. So I can, like, keep replaying that, trying to.
Oh, no, I don't think about her hardly at all. You know, I just don't anymore, and it's a gift. I think that her writing that email was smart because it really put things into perspective. And I don't, you know, and I know there's no reason for us to have a relationship or to talk or any of it. There's no reason. But I do think in whatever fucked up way that I was capable of, I was in love with that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may not have manifested that way. It may have been driven by a lot of other things, but I was, right? It might not have been healthy love, whatever the fuck it was. But it was a profound event in my life.
Yeah, because how long were you guys together?
Like 7 years, 7.5 years.
Yeah, well, when I met both of you, you were always together.
Yeah. She just like, but like, it was one of those things where like my insanity just, like by the time she left, she just hated me. So like there was no...
Well, I heard you describe that before, that you were kind of like just making her...
Hate me.
Well, you were making her your everything, right? So you weren't...
Oh, yeah.
You know, feel you, that when you make someone your everything, it's a setup for disappointment, right?
Dude, she got me sober and I grabbed on. I mean, what are the fucking odds of that?
Yeah.
But like, I learned all this stuff after the fact.
Yeah, of course.
But there's moments where... Like, I remember my emotionally abusive behavior, and I'm ashamed and sad. Like, I can see her looking at me in a way where I'm like, where when I feel that, I'm like, you're this awful person.
Wow, that's really deep, Mark. Like, what would help alleviate that for you?
I don't know. What do you think?
What's your sponsor say?
I don't know. We've sort of moved through all that. You know, like the Mishnah book is closed. But that's an interesting question, though, for those two specific events. That moment where I realized that, you know, she did not love me anymore because of my behavior. And the moment where she left me. Those are interesting points.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I feel like they're behind me and I'm okay. But maybe I just stuffed them.
And maybe, I mean, what, when you... I mean, it's sort of rhetorical, but what could give you peace?
I have peace.
Around, okay, so you have peace. So what is...
I think there's a shame thing. I think that there is still a, you know, whatever the amends process gives me or however I have made a living in amends, I think I'm ashamed of that man that I was, especially in that relationship.
Yeah, so like what's the
I don't know.
Antidote?
I'll ask.
For shame?
To act better.
To act better, of
and
course.
And let yourself off the hook a bit.
Thank you.
That you did you processed it, you made an amends. You know, everyone's alive, everyone's moved on to their lives and they're okay. So, you know, at some point you just got to say like, all right, you know, you're better now. And you know, that was a bad time and you made some mistakes and you were sort of a shitty person, but you're better. What are you gonna do?
Yeah.
People change.
People change. And forgiveness.
Forgive myself.
Forgiveness of yourself.
Yeah, I was a dick.
You know, I mean, look, we all have been, you know, but, you know, it's like allowing yourself to rewrite the narrative moving forward.
Boy, I have been through three lifetimes since then.
Being a different, how can I be a different person now? Like, that's all we have, right? And it's like,
that's all you can do.
How can we?
We're doing it.
Have you heard the acronym for shame? Should have already mastered everything.
Oh, that's a good one. Where'd that one come from?
One of the secret societies.
Yeah.
I don't know. When I wrote Dylan.
The amends?
An amends via Facebook. Not wanting to disturb him and his family. He was like, hey, don't you owe me some money? So that amends cost me an additional $1,000. And you know what? I was happy to pay it because I was like, thank you for giving me something tangible that I can do to get right with you.
One thing I don't owe her is fucking money. That I can tell you with full confidence.
What do you think has helped you the most? Is it therapy? Or is it like
other things?
What helped with your rage? That's a really big thing to turn around.
Well, just that, like, I just had to identify where it was coming from, you know, which was like this fear and, you know, insecurity about receiving love or having control. Like, I just somehow or another identified the source of it and what it did. And also, you hurt people enough, you know, you're sort of a monster if you don't take responsibility for that. And, you know, it took a while to temper it. But like when I was younger, when I was just getting sober, certainly during that relationship with Misna, I was just crazy because I was jealous and I was trying to control and I couldn't believe that she would like me. So I was hating myself and projecting that. I mean, that has a lot to do with it. I think the more self-esteem I got from, you know, kind of pulling out of that relationship and finding some success in my life really makes a big difference.
Yeah, that you were like...
Well, everything I worked for maybe wasn't for nothing, and that like I am good at what I do, and I feel okay about myself. Like, so a lot of that filling in, some of that self-esteem just from esteemable acts and from, you know, working helped.
Do you think that work started to come to you more when you had that internal switch, or was it vice versa?
I just think, like, you know, by the time I started the podcast, I'd really let go of the idea that I would be a successful comedian, that I would act, all that stuff. I was like, I got to be grown up about this and know that it's not going to happen for me and accept that. And, you know, whatever heartache comes from that. And I've got to figure out where I go from here because I'm not prepared to do a job in any way. And so that's what, and then started talking on the mic, you know. And I always did stand up, but I had to lower my expectations a great deal and believe it, really let it go, that nothing was owed me and that, you know, if it doesn't happen, that's just life. You know, no one counts on that in show business. No one enters show business thinking they're not going to make it. We all think we're going to do something, you know, but the percentage of times that works out is small, relatively speaking. I mean, you can find your way, you can find your groove. You know, you can survive sometimes. So, but I knew I couldn't, like, I knew that there was no way I could go on doing, you know, like, stand-up if I was just going to be, like, a B-room headliner for the rest of my life. Like, it was, like, there was a lot of dark visions going on.
Yeah.
But I just focused on doing the podcast.
I started one on my couch during COVID.
What's it called?
It's called Let's Process This.
And that's available?
Yeah, it's available. I do it on IG Live. And
you don't put it up on iTunes as a podcast?
I do. It's on iTunes and everywhere. But it's just, I couldn't really meet with people during COVID. So I just started doing it from my couch.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then you have guests on IG Live?
Yeah.
Okay. And you were able to record them?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not guaranteeing a great sound or anything.
Okay. Got it.
But yeah, it's we're really talking about like how people are processing their trauma,
okay,
how they're healing from it, and how that affects their creative process, or how they're turning that into creative treasure.
Oh.
So it'll be like people who created a TV show. We've had a few like showrunners and comedians and, you know, just people who've turned whatever they've overcome around.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and talk about creative process, which I'm like so fascinated with, creative process and healing process.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're going to open a school of some kind.
What? What kind of school?
A therapeutic processing space.
I wouldn't be able to start a school. That's too much admin for me. I can barely do a podcast from my couch.
Okay. All right. Nice talking to you.
You too, Mark.
We're going to cut about an hour and a half of this.
You can release that hour and a half as its own special.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for coming over. We covered it all. Again, she wanted you to know that she and her parents are good. They're good. She's good with her parents. Okay. Her special, Melinda Hill Inappropriate, is available now on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, YouTube, and most other video on demand platforms. And now I will just play a simple blues for you. A simple blues for you. Thank you.
Boomer lives. Monkey, LaFonda, they all fucking live.
Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here. And when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.